Look, why, it almost looks as if those lips are smiling. Farther on, the knight paused briefly to consider a jeweled tiara displayed upon a bed of purple velvet. He passed that by, but a few steps on, he stopped again to haggle over a pair of gloves at a leather worker's stall. Tyrion was grateful for the respites. The headlong pace had left him puffing, and his wrists were chafed raw from the manacles. From the far end of the long bridge, it was only a short walk through the teeming waterfront districts of the West Bank, down torchlit streets crowded with sailors, slaves, and drunken merrymakers. Once an elephant lumbered past with a dozen half-naked slave girls wavering from the castle on its back, teasing passers-by with glimpses of their breasts.
"Malaquo! Malaquo!"
They made such an entrancing sight that Tyrion almost waddled right into the steaming pile of dung the elephant had left to mark its passage. He was saved at the last instant when the knight snatched him aside, yanking on his chain so hard it made him reel and stumble. "How much farther?" the dwarf asked.
"Just there, Fishmonger Square."
Their destination proved to be the merchant's house, a four-story monstrosity that squatted amongst the warehouses, brothels, and taverns of the waterside like some enormous fat man surrounded by children. Its common room was larger than the great halls of half the castles in Westeros, a dim-lit maze of a place with 100 private alcoves and hidden nooks whose blackened beams and cracked ceilings echoed to the din of sailors, traders, captains, money-changers, shippers, and slavers lying, cursing, and cheating each other in 50 different tongues. Tyrion approved the choice of hostelry. Soon or late, the shy maid must reach Valantis. This was the city's biggest inn, first choice for shippers, captains, and merchantmen. A lot of business was done in that cavernous warren of a common room. He knew enough of Valantis to know that. Let Griff turn up here with Duck and Holden, and he would be free again soon enough. Meanwhile, he would be patient. His chance would come. The rooms upstairs proved rather less than grand, however, particularly the cheap ones up on the fourth floor. Wedged into a corner of the building beneath a sloping roof, the bedchamber his captor had engaged featured a low ceiling, a sagging feather bed with an unpleasant odor, and a slanting wood-plank floor that reminded Tyrion of his sojourn at the Eyrie. "At least this room has walls." It had windows, too. Those were its chief amenity, along with the iron ring set in the wall, so useful for chaining up one's slaves. His captor paused only long enough to light a tallow candle before securing Tyrion's chains to the ring.
"Must you?"
the dwarf protested, rattling feebly.
"Where am I going to go? Out the window?"
"You might."
"We are four floors up, and I cannot fly."
"You can fall. I want you alive."
"Aye, but why, Cersei is not like to care." Tyrion rattled his chains. "I know who you are, sir." It had not been hard to puzzle out. The bear in his surcoat, the arms on his shield, the lost lordship he had mentioned. "I know what you are, and if you know who I am, you also know that I was the king's hand, and sat in council with the spider. Would it interest you to know that it was the eunuch who dispatched me on this journey?"
"Him and Jamie, but I'll leave my brother out of it.
I am as much his creature as you are. We ought not to be at odds."
That did not please the knight. "I took the spider's coin, I'll not deny it, but I was never his creature, and my loyalties lie elsewhere now. With Cersei? Oh, more fool you. All my sister requires is my head, and you have a fine sharp sword. Why not end this farce now, and spare us both?"
The knight laughed.
"Is this some dwarf's trick? Beg for death, in hopes I'll let you live?"
He went to the door.
"I'll bring you something from the kitchens." "How kind of you. I'll wait here.
I know you will.
Yet when the knight left, he locked the door behind him with a heavy iron key. The merchant's house was famous for its locks.
As secure as a jail, the dwarf thought bitterly. But at least there are those windows.
Tyrion knew that the chances of his escaping his chains were little and less, but even so, he felt obliged to try. His efforts to slip a hand through the manacle served only to scrape off more skin and leave his wrist slick with blood, and all his tugging or twisting could not pull the iron ring from the wall. "Bugger this," he thought, slumping back as far as his chains would allow. His legs had begun to cramp. This was going to be a hellishly uncomfortable night. "The first of many, I do not doubt." The room was stifling, so the knight had opened the shutters to let in a cross breeze. Cramped into a corner of the building under the eaves, the chamber was fortunate in having two windows. One looked toward the long bridge and the black-walled heart of Old Valentis across the river. The other opened on the square below. Fishermonger's Square, Mormont called it. As tight as the chains were, Tyrion found he could see out of the latter by leaning sideways and letting the iron ring support his weight. Not as long a fall as the one from Lysa Arryn's sky cells, but it would leave me just as dead. Perhaps if I were drunk. Even at this hour, the square was crowded, with sailors roistering, whores prowling for custom, and merchants going about their business. A red priestess scurried past, attended by a dozen acolytes with torches, their robes whisking about their ankles. Elsewhere, a pair of Syvas players waged war outside a tavern. A slave stood beside their table, holding a lantern over the board. Tyrion could hear a woman singing. The words were strange. The tune was soft and sad. "If I knew what she was singing, I might cry." Closer to hand, a crowd was gathering around a pair of jugglers throwing flaming torches at each other. His captor returned shortly, carrying two tankards and a roasted duck. He kicked the door shut, ripped the duck in two, and tossed half of it to Tyrion. He would have snatched it from the air, but his chains brought him up short when he tried to lift his arms. Instead, the bird struck his temple and slid hot and greasy down his face, and he had to hunker down and stretch for it with fetters clanking. He got it on the third try, and happily tore into it with his teeth. "Some ale to wash this down?" Mormont handed him a tankard. "Most of Valantis is getting drunk. Why not you?" The ale was sweet as well. It tasted of fruit. Tyrion drank a healthy swallow and belched happily. The tankard was pewter, very heavy. "Empty it and fling it as he said," he thought. "If I am lucky, it might crack his skull. If I am very lucky, it will miss, and he'll beat me to death with his fists." He took another gulp. "Is this some holy day?"
"Third day of their elections. They last for 10 days of madness. Torchlight marches, speeches, mummers and minstrels and dancers, bravos fighting death duels for the honour of their candidates, elephants with the names of would-be triarchs painted on their sides. Those jugglers are performing for Methiso." "Remind me to vote for someone else." Tyrion licked grease from his fingers. Below, the crowd was flinging coins at the jugglers.
"Do all these would-be triarchs provide mama shows?"
"They do whatever they think will win them votes," said Mormont. "Food, drink, spectacle. Elias has sent 100 pretty slave girls out into the streets to lay with voters."
"I'm for him," Tyrion decided. "Bring me a slave girl. They're for freeborn volunteers with enough property to vote. Precious few voters west of the river." "And this goes on for 10 days?
Tyrion laughed.
I might enjoy that, though 3 kings is too many. I am trying to imagine ruling the 7 kingdoms with my sweet sister and brave brother beside me. One of us would kill the other 2 inside a year. I am surprised these triarchs don't do the same."
"If you have tried,
might be the Volantines or the Clever Ones, and us Westerosi, the fools. Valantis has known her share of follies, but she's never suffered a boy triarch. Whenever a madman's been elected, his colleagues restrain him until his year has run its course. Think of the dead who might still live if mad Ares only had two fellow kings to share the rule.
Instead he had my father, Tyrion thought.
Some of the free cities think that we're all savages on our side of the narrow sea, the knight went on. The others think that we're children, crying out for a father's strong hand.
Or a mother's. Cersei will love that, especially when he presents her with my head.
You seem to know this city well.
I spent the best part of a year here. The knight sloshed the dregs at the bottom of his tankard. When Stark drove me into exile, I fled to Lys with my second wife. Braavos would have suited me better, but Lyonesse wanted some place warm. Instead of serving the Bravossi, I fought them on the Rhoyne, but for every silver I earned, my wife spent 10. By the time I got back to Lys, she had taken a lover, who told me cheerfully that I would be enslaved for debt unless I gave her up and left the city. That was how I came to Valantis. One step ahead of slavery, owning nothing but my sword and the clothes upon my back. And now you want to run home? The knight drained the last of his ale. On the morrow, I'll find us a ship. The bed is mine. You can have whatever piece of floor your chains will let you reach. Sleep, if you can. If not, count your crimes. That should see you through till the morning.
You have your crimes to answer for, Jorah Mormont, the dwarf thought. But it seemed wiser to keep that thought to himself. Sir Jorah hung his sword belt on a bedpost, kicked off his boots, pulled his chainmail over his head, and stripped out of his wool and leather and sweat-stained undertunic to reveal a scarred, brawny torso covered with dark hair.
"If I could skin him, I could sell that pelt for a fur coat,"
Tyrion thought, as Mormont tumbled into the slightly smelly comfort of his sagging feather bed. In no time at all the knight was snoring, leaving his prize alone with his chains. With both windows open wide, the light of the waning moon spilled across the bedchamber. Sounds drifted up from the square below, snatches of drunken song, the yowling of a cat in heat, the far-off ring of steel on steel. "Someone's about to die," thought Tyrion. His wrist was throbbing where he'd torn the skin, and his fetters made it impossible for him to sit, let alone stretch out. The best he could do was twist sideways to lean against the wall, and before long he began to lose all feeling in his hands. When he moved to relieve the strain, sensation came flooding back as pain. He had to grind his teeth to keep from screaming. He wondered how much his father had hurt when the quarrel punched through his groin, what Shay had felt as he twisted the chain around her lying throat, what Tysha had been feeling as they raped her. His sufferings were nothing compared to their own, but that did not make him hurt any less.
"Just make it stop."
Sir Jorah had rolled onto one side, so all that Tyrion could see of him was a broad, hairy, muscular back.
"Even if I could slip these chains, I'd need to climb over him to reach his sword belt. Perhaps if I could ease the dagger loose..."
Or else he could try for the key, unlock the door, creep down the stairs and through the common room.
"And go where? I have no friends, no coin. I do not even speak the local tongue."
Exhaustion finally overwhelmed his pains, and Tyrion drifted off into a fitful sleep. But every time another cramp took root inside his calf and twisted, the dwarf would cry out in his sleep, trembling in his chains. He woke with every muscle aching to find morning streaming through the windows, bright and golden as the Lion of Lannister. Below he could hear the cries of fishmongers and the rumble of iron-rimmed wheels on cobblestones. Jorah Mormont was standing over him.
"If I take off the ring, will you do as you're told?
Will it involve dancing? I might find dancing difficult. I cannot feel my legs. They may have fallen off. Elsewise, I am your creature, on my honour as a Lannister."
"The Lannisters have no honour."
Sir Jorah loosed his chains anyway. Tyrion took two wobbly steps and fell. The blood rushing back into his hands brought tears to his eyes. He bit his lip and said,
"Wherever we're going, you will need to roll me there."
Instead, the big knight carried him, hoisting him by the chain between his wrists. The common room of the merchant's house was a dim labyrinth of alcoves and grottos built around a central courtyard where a trellis of flowering vines threw intricate patterns across a flagstone floor, and green and purple moss grew between the stones. Slave girls scurried through light and shadow, bearing flagons of ale and wine and some ice-green drink that smelled of mint. One table in 20 was occupied at this hour of the morning. One of those was occupied by a dwarf, clean-shaven and pink-cheeked, with a mop of chestnut hair, a heavy brow, and a squashed nose. He perched on a high stool with a wooden spoon in his hand, contemplating a bowl of purplish gruel with red-rimmed eyes.
"A gray little bastard," Tyrion thought.
The other dwarf felt his stare. When he raised his head and saw Tyrion, the spoon slipped from his hand.
"He saw me," Tyrion warned Mormont. "What of it? He knows me, who I am. Should I stuff you in a sack, so no one will see you?"
The knight touched the hilt of his longsword.
"If he means to try and take you, he is welcome to try."
"Welcome to die, you mean," thought Tyrion. "What threat could he pose to a big man like you? He's only a dwarf." Sir Jorah claimed a table in a quiet corner and ordered food and drink. They broke their fast with warm, soft flatbread, pink fish roe, honey sausage, and fried locust, washed down with a bittersweet black ale. Tyrion ate like a man half-starved.
"You have a healthy appetite this morning," the knight observed.
"I've heard the food in hell is wretched."
Tyrion glanced at the door where a man had just come in. Tall and stooped, his pointed beard was dyed a splotchy purple.
"Some Tyrushi trader."
A gust of sound came with him from outside. The cries of gulls, a woman's laughter, the voices of the fishmongers. For half a heartbeat, he thought he glimpsed Illyrio Mopatis. But it was only one of those white dwarf elephants passing the front door. Mormont spread some fish roe across a slice of flatbread and took a bite.
"Are you expecting someone?"
Tyrion shrugged.
"You never know who the wind might blow in. My one true love, my father's ghost, a duck."
He popped a locust into his mouth and crunched it.
Not bad. For a bug.
Last night the talk here was all of Westeros. Some exiled lord has hired the Golden Company to win back his lands for him. Half the captains in Volantis are racing upriver to Volantheris to offer him their ships. Tyrion had just swallowed another locust. He almost choked on it.
Is he mucking me? How much could he know of Griffin Aegon?
"Bugger," he said. "I meant to hire Golden Company myself to win me Casterly Rock."
Could this be some ploy of Griff's? False reports deliberately spread? Unless...
Could the pretty princeling have swallowed the bait? Turn them west instead of east, abandoning his hopes of wedding Queen Daenerys?
Abandoning the dragons? Would Griff allow that?
"I gladly hire you as well, sir. My father's seat is mine by rights. Swear me your sword, and once I win it back, I'll drown you in gold."
I saw a man drowned in gold once. It was not a pretty sight. If you ever get my sword, it will be through your bowels. "A sure cure for constipation," said Tyrion. "Just ask my father."
He reached for his tankard and took a slow swallow to help conceal whatever might be showing on his face.
It had to be a stratagem, designed to lull Volantine's suspicions. Get the men aboard with this false pretext, and seize the ships when the fleet is out to sea. Is that Griff's plan?
It might work. The Golden Company was 10,000 strong, seasoned and disciplined.
None of them seamen, though. Griff will need to keep a sword at every throat, and should they come on Slaver's Bay and need to fight...
The serving girl returned.
"The widow will see you next, noble sir. Have you brought a gift for her?"
"Yes, thank you." Sir Jorrel slipped a coin into the girl's palm and sent her on her way. Tyrion frowned. "Whose widow is this?"
"The widow of the waterfront, east of the Roin. They still call her Vogaro's whore, though never to her face."
The dwarf was not enlightened.
"And Vogaro was?"
"An elephant. 7 times a triarch. Very rich. A power on the docks. Whilst other men built the ships and sailed them, he built piers and storehouses, brokered cargoes, changed money, insured ship owners against the hazards of the sea. He dealt in slaves as well. When he grew besotted with one of them, a bed slave trained at Yunkai in the way of 7 sighs, it was a great scandal, and a greater scandal when he freed her and took her for his wife. After he died, she carried on his ventures. No freedman may dwell within the Black Wall, so she was compelled to sell Vogari's mets. She took up residence at the merchant's house. That was 32 years ago, and she remains here to this day. That's her behind you, back by the courtyard, holding court at her customary table. No, don't look. There's someone with her now. When he's done, it will be our turn.
And this old harridan will help you?
How?
Sir Jorah stood.
Watch and see. He's leaving.
Tyrion hopped down off his chair with a rattle of iron.
This should be enlightening.
There was something vulpine about the way the woman sat in her corner by the courtyard, something reptilian about her eyes. Her white hair was so thin that the pink of her scalp showed through. Under one eye she still bore faint scars where a knife had cut away her tears. The remnants of her morning meal littered the table, sardine heads, olive pits, chunks of flatbread. Tyrion did not fail to note how well chosen her customary table was. Solid stone at her back, a leafy alcove to one side for entrances and exits, a perfect view of the inn's front door, yet so steeped in shadow that she herself was nigh invisible. The sight of him made the old woman smile.
"A dwarf,"
she purred, in a voice as sinister as it was soft. She spoke the common tongue with only a trace of accent.
"Volantis has been overrun with dwarfs of late, it seems. Does this one do tricks?"
"Yes," Tyrion wanted to say. "Give me a crossbow, and I'll show you my favourite."
No, Sir Jorah answered. "A pity. I once had a monkey who could perform all sorts of clever tricks. Your dwarf reminds me of him. Is he a gift?"
No. I brought you these."
Sir Jorah produced his pair of gloves and slapped them down on the table beside the other gifts the widow had received this morning. A silver goblet, an ornate fan carved of jade leaves, so thin they were translucent, and an ancient bronze dagger marked with runes. Besides such treasures, the gloves looked cheap and tawdry.
"Gloves for my poor old wrinkled hands! How nice!"
The widow made no move to touch them.
"I bought them on the Long Bridge."
"A man can buy most anything on the Long Bridge. Gloves, slaves, monkeys."
The years had bent her spine and put a crone's hump upon her back. But the widow's eyes were bright and black.
Now tell this old widow how she may be of service to you.
We need swift passage east to Meereen. One word, Tyrion Lannister's world turned upside down. One word, Meereen, or had he misheard? One word,
Meereen. He said Meereen. He's taking me to Meereen.
Meereen meant life, or hope for life, at least.
Why come to me? The widow said. I own no ships.
You have many captains in your debt.
Deliver me to the queen, he says. Aye, but which queen? He isn't selling me to Cersei. He's giving me to Daenerys Targaryen. That's why he hasn't hacked my head off. We're going east, and Griff and his prince are going west, the bloody fools.
Oh, it was all too much. Plots within plots, but all roads lead down the dragon's gullet. A guffaw burst from his lips, and suddenly Tyrion could not stop laughing.
Your dwarf is having a fit,
the widow observed. My dwarf will be quiet, or I'll see him gagged. Tyrion covered his mouth with his hands.
Meereen!
The widow of the waterfront decided to ignore him.
Shall we have a drink?
She asked. Dust motes floated in the air as a serving girl filled two green glass cups for Ser Jorah and the widow. Tyrion's throat was dry, but no cup was poured for him. The widow took a sip, rolled the wine around her mouth, swallowed.
All the other exiles are sailing west, or so these old ears have heard, and all those captains in my debt are falling over one another to take them there, and leech a little gold from the coffers of the Golden Company. Our noble triarchs have pledged a dozen warships to the cause, to see the fleet safely as far as the Stepstones. Even old Dunifuss has given his assent. Such a glorious adventure. And yet you would go the other way, sir.
My business is in the east.
And what business is that, I wonder? Not slaves. The Silver Queen has put an end to that. She has closed the fighting pits as well, so it cannot be a taste for blood. What else could Meereen offer to a Westerosi knight? Bricks? Olives? Dragons? Ah, there it is.
The old woman's smile turned feral.
I've heard it said that the Silver Queen feeds them with the flesh of infants, while she herself bathes in the blood of virgin girls and takes a different lover every night.
Ser Jorah's mouth had hardened. The Yunkai are pouring poison in your ears.
My lady should not believe such filth. Oh, I'm no lady, but even Vergara's whore knows the taste of falsehood. This much is true, though. The Dragon Queen has enemies, Yunkai, Newgis, Tollis, Garth, aye, and Valantis soon enough. You would travel to Meereen. Just wait a while, sir. Swords will be wanted soon enough when the warships bend their oars eastwards to bring down the Silver Queen. Tigers love to bare their claws, and even elephants will kill if threatened. Malaquo hungers for a taste of glory, and Nisus owes much of his wealth to the slave trade. Let Alios or Perquello or Belicho gain the triarchy, and the fleets will sail.
Ser Jorah scowled. If Dunifuss is returned,
Volgaro will be returned first, and my sweet lord has been dead these 30 years.
Behind them some sailor was bellowing loudly.
They call this ale? Fuck! A monkey could piss better ale.
And you would drink it? Another voice replied. Tyrion twisted round for a look, hoping against hope that it was Duck and Holden he was hearing. Instead, he saw two strangers, and the dwarf, who was standing a few feet away, staring at him intently. He seemed somehow familiar. The widow sipped daintily at her wine.
"Some of the first elephants were women," she said. "The ones who brought the tigers down and ended the old wars. Triana was returned 4 times. That was 300 years ago, alas. Valantis has had no female triarch since, though some women have the vote. Women of good birth who dwell in ancient palaces behind the black walls, not creatures such as me. The old blood will have their dogs and children voting before any freedmen. No, it will be Belicho, or perhaps Alias, but either way it will be war, or so they think.
And what do you think? Ser Jorah asked.
Good, thought Tyrion.
The right question.
Oh, I think it will be war as well, but not the war they want.
The old woman leaned forward, her black eyes gleaming.
I think that Red Willow has more worshippers in this city than all the other gods together. Have you heard Benero preach?
Last night.
Benero can see the morrow in his flames, the widow said. Triarch Malaquo tried to hire the Golden Company, did you know? He meant to clean out the Red Temple and put Benero to the sword. He dare not use tiger cloaks. Half of them worship the Lord of Light as well. Oh, these are dire days in old Valentis, even for wrinkled old widows. But not half so dire as in Meereen, I think. So tell me, sir, why do you seek the Silver Queen?
That is my concern. I can pay for our passage, and pay well. I have the silver.
Fool, thought Tyrion. It's not coin she wants, it's respect. Haven't you heard a word she said?
He glanced back over his shoulder again. The dwarf had moved closer to their table, and he seemed to have a knife in his hand. The hairs on the back of his neck began to prickle.
Keep your silver, I have gold, and spare me your black look, sir. I'm too old to be frightened of a skull. You are a hard man, I see, and no doubt skilled with that long sword at your side. But this is my realm. Let me crook a finger, and you may find yourself travelling to Meereen, chained to an oar in the belly of a galley.
She lifted her jade fan and opened it. There was a rustle of leaves, and a man slid from the overgrown archway to her left. His face was a mass of scars, and in one hand he held a sword, short and heavy as a cleaver.
"Seek the widow of the waterfront, someone told you. But they should have also warned you, beware the widow's sons. It is such a sweet morning, though, I shall ask again. Why would you seek Daenerys Targaryen, whom half the world wants dead?"
Jorah Mormont's face was dark with anger, but he answered, "To serve her, defend her, die for her, if need be." That made the widow laugh.
"'You want to rescue her? Is that the way of it? Far more enemies than I can name, with swords beyond count. This is what you have the poor widow believe, that you are a true and chivalrous Westerosi knight, crossing half the world to come to the aid of this, well, she's no maiden, though she may still be fair."
She laughed again.
"Do you think your dwarf will please her? Will she bathe in his blood, do you think, or content herself with striking off his head?"
Ser Jorah hesitated. "The dwarf is—"
"I know who the dwarf is, and what he is."
Her black eyes turned to Tyrion, hard as stone.
"Kinslayer, Kingslayer, murderer, turncloak, Lannister."
She made the last a curse.
"What do you plan to offer the Dragon Queen, little man?"
"My hate," Tyrion wanted to say. Instead, he spread his hands as far as the fetters would allow.
"Whatever she would have of me.
Sage counsel, savage wit, a bit of tumbling, my cock if she desires it, my tongue if she does not. I will lead her armies or rub her feet as she desires. And the only reward I ask is I might be allowed to rape and kill my sister."
That brought the smile back to the old woman's face.
"This one, at least, is honest," she announced. "But you, sir, I have known a dozen Westerosi knights and 1,000 adventurers of the same ilk, but none so pure as you would paint yourself. Men are beasts, selfish and brutal. However gentle the words, there are always darker motives underneath. I do not trust you, sir."
She flicked them off with her fan, as if they were no more than flies buzzing about her head.
"If you want to get to Meereen, swim. I have no help to give you."
Then 7 hells broke out at once. Sir Jorah started to rise. The widow snapped her fan closed. Her scarred man slid out of the shadows. And behind them, a girl screamed. Tyrion spun just in time to see the dwarf rushing toward him.
"She's a girl," he realized all at once. "A girl dressed up in man's clothes. And she means to gut me with that knife."
For half a heartbeat, Sir Jorah, the widow, and the scarred man stood still as stone. Idlers watched from nearby tables, sipping ale and wine, but no one moved to interfere. Tyrion had to move both hands at once, but his chains had just enough give for him to reach the flagon on the table. He closed his fist around it, spun, dashed its contents into the face of the charging dwarf girl, then threw himself to one side to avoid her knife. The flagon shattered underneath him as the floor came up to smack him in the head. Then the girl was on him once again. Tyrion rolled to one side as she buried the knife blade in the floorboards, yanked it free, raised it again. And suddenly she was rising off the floor, legs kicking wildly as she struggled in Sir Jorah's grasp.
"No," she wailed in the common tongue of Westeros. "Let go!"
Tyrion heard her tunic rip as she fought to free herself. Mormont had her by the collar with one hand. With the other, he wrenched the dagger from her grasp.
"Enough!"
The landlord made his appearance then, a cudgel in his hand, but when he saw the broken flagon, he uttered a blistering curse and demanded to know what had happened here.
"Dwarf fight," replied the Tyrusher with a purple beard, chuckling.
Tyrion blinked up at the dripping girl twisting in the air.
"Why?" he demanded. "What did I ever do to you?"
"They killed him!"
All the fight went out of her at that. She hung limply in Mormon's grasp, as her eyes filled with tears.
"My brother, they took him, and they killed him."
"Who killed him?" asked Mormon.
"Sailors. Sailors from the 7 kingdoms. There were 5 of them, drunk. They saw us jousting in the square and followed us. When they realized I was a girl, they let me go, but they took my brother and killed him. They cut his head off."
Tyrion felt a sudden shock of recognition.
"They saw us jousting in the square?" He knew who the girl was then. "Did you ride the pig," he asked her, "or the dog?"
"The dog," she sobbed. "Uppo always rode the pig."
"The dwarfs from Joffrey's wedding. It was their show that had started all the trouble that night. How strange to encounter them again, half a world away, though perhaps not so strange as that. If they'd had half the wits of their pig, they would have fled King's Landing the night Joff died, before Cersei could assign them some share of blame in her son's death."
"Let her down, sir," he told Sir Jorah Mormont. "She won't do us any harm." Sir Jorah dumped the dwarf girl on the floor. "I'm sorry for your brother, but we had no part in his murder."
"He did."
The girl pushed herself to her knees, clutching her torn, wine-drenched tunic to small, pale breasts.
"It was him they wanted. They thought Upper was him."
The girl was weeping, begging for help from anyone who would listen.
"He should die, the way my poor brother died. Please, someone help me. Someone kill him."
The landlord seized her roughly by one arm and wrenched her back to her feet, shouting in Volantine, demanding to know who was going to pay for this damage. The widow of the waterfront gave Mormont a cool look.
"Knights defend the weak and protect the innocent, they say. and I am the fairest maid in all Volantis.
Her laugh was full of scorn.
What do they call you, child?
Penny.
The old woman called out to the landlord in the tongue of old Volantis. Tyrion knew enough to understand that she was telling him to take the dwarf girl up to her rooms, give her wine, and find some clothes for her to wear. When they were gone, the widow studied Tyrion, her black eyes shining.
Monsters should be larger, it seems to me. You're worth a lordship back in Westeros, little man. Here, I fear, your worth is somewhat less. But I think I'd best help you after all. Volantis is no safe place for dwarfs, it seems.
You are too kind. Tyrion gave her his sweetest smile.
Perhaps you would be so kind as to remove these charming iron bracelets as well. This monster has but half a nose, and it itches most abominably. The chains are too short for me to scratch it. I'll make you a gift of them, and gladly.
How generous! But I have worn iron in my time, and now I find that I prefer gold and silver. And sad to say, this is Volantis, where fetters and chains are cheaper than day-old bread, and it is forbidden to help a slave escape.
I am no slave.
Oh, every man ever taken by slavers sings that same sad song. I dare not help you. Here.
She leaned forward again.
2 days from now, the cog, Senasori Corrin, will set sail for Karth by way of New Gith, carrying tin and iron, bales of wool and lace, 50 Mirish carpets, a corpse pickled in brine, 20 jars of dragon peppers, and a red priest. Be on her when she sails.
We will, said Tyrion, and thank you. Ser Jorah frowned.
Karth is not our destination. She will never reach Karth. Benero has seen it in his fires.
The crone smiled, a vulpine smile. As you say, Tyrion grinned, if I were Valentine and free and had the blood, you'd have my vote for Treyarch, my lady.
I'm no lady, the widow replied, just Volgaro's whore. You want to be gone from here before the tigers come. Should you reach your queen, give her a message from the slaves of old Volantis.
She touched the faded scar upon her wrinkled cheek, where her tears had been cut away.
Tell her we are waiting. Tell her to come soon.
John. When he heard the order, Sir Alistair's mouth twisted into a semblance of a smile, but his eyes remained as cold and hard as flint.
So, the bastard boy sends me out to die.
Die,
cried Mormont's raven.
Die, die, die.
You are not helping. John swatted the bird away. The bastard boy is sending you out to range, to find our foes, and kill them if need be. You are skilled with a blade. You are master at arms here and at Eastwatch. Thorne touched the hilt of his longsword.
I have squandered a third of my life trying to teach the rudiments of swordplay to churls, muttonheads, and knaves. Small good that will do me in those woods.
Diamond will be with you, and another seasoned ranger.
We'll learn you what you need to know, sir.
Diamond told Thorne, cackling.
Teach you how to wipe your high-born arse with leaves, just like a proper ranger.
Cage White-Eye laughed at that, and Blackjack Bulwer spat. Sir Alistair only said,
you would like me to refuse. Then you could hack off me head, same as you did for Slint. I not give you that pleasure, bastard. You'd best pray that it's a wildling blade that kills me, though. The ones the others kill don't stay dead, and they remember. I'm coming back, Lord Snow.
I pray you do,
Jumba never counts Sir Alistair Thorne amongst his friends, but he was still a brother. No one ever said you had to like your brothers. It was no easy thing to send men into the wild, knowing that the chances were good that they might never return. They are all seasoned men, John told himself. But his uncle Benjen and his rangers had been seasoned men as well, and the haunted forest had swallowed them up without a trace. When two of them finally came straggling back to the wall, it had been as whites. Not for the first time or the last, John Snow found himself wondering what had become of Benjen Stark. Perhaps the rangers would come upon some sign of them, he told himself, never truly believing it. Dywin would lead one ranging, Blackjack Bulwer and Kedge Whiteye the other two. They at least were eager for the duty.
"Feels good to have a horse under me again," Dywin said at the gate, sucking on his wooden teeth. "Begging your pardon, my lord, but we was all of us getting splinters up our arses from sitting about."
No man in Castle Black knew the woods as well as Dywin did. The trees and streams, the plants that could be eaten, the ways of predator and prey. Thorn is in better hands than he deserves. John watched the riders go from atop the wall. Three parties, each of three men, each carrying a pair of ravens. From on high their garrons looked no larger than ants, and John could not tell one ranger from another. He knew them, though. Every name was graven on his heart. Eight good men, he thought, and one, well, we shall see. When the last of the riders had disappeared into the trees, John Snow rode the winch cage down with Dolorous Ed. A few scattered snowflakes were falling as they made their slow descent, dancing on the gusty wind. One followed the cage down, drifting just beyond the bars. It was falling faster than they were descending, and from time to time it would vanish beneath them. Then a gust of wind would catch it and push it upwards once again. John could have reached through the bars and caught it, if he had wished.
"I had a frightening dream last night, my lord," Dolorous Ed confessed. "You were my steward, eh, fetching my food and cleaning up my leavings. I was Lord Commander, with never a moment's peace."
John did not smile. "Your nightmare, my life." Cutterpike's galleys were reporting ever-increasing numbers of free folk along the wooded shores to the north and east of the wall. Camps had been seen, half-built rafts, even the hull of a broken cog that someone had begun repairing. The wildlings always vanished into the woods when seen, no doubt to re-emerge as soon as Pike's ships had passed. Meanwhile, Sir Denis Mallister was still seeing fires in the night north of the gorge. Both commanders were asking for more men.
"And where am I to get more men?"
John had sent 10 of the Molestown wildlings to each of them, green boys, old men, some wounded and infirm, but all capable of doing work of one sort or another. Far from being pleased, Pike and Mallister had both written back to complain.
"When I asked for men, I had in mind men of the Night's Watch, trained and disciplined, whose loyalty I should never have reason to doubt," wrote Sir Denis.
Cutterpike was blunter. "I could hang them from the wall as a warning to other wildlings to stay away, but I don't see any other use for them." Maester Harmoon wrote for him.
"I wouldn't trust such to clean my chamber pot, and 10 is not enough."
The iron cage moved downward at the end of its long chain, creaking and rattling, until it finally jerked to a halt a foot above the ground at the base of the wall. Dolorous Ed pushed open the door and hopped down, his boots breaking the crust of the last snow. John followed. Outside the armory, Iron Emmett was still urging on his charges in the yard. The song of steel on steel woke a hunger in John. It reminded him of warmer, simpler days when he had been a boy at Winterfell, matching blades with Rob, under the watchful eye of Sir Roderick Cassell. Sir Roderick, too, had fallen, slain by Theon Turncloak and his iron men
as he tried to retake Winterfell. The great stronghold of House Stark was a scorched desolation. All my memories are poisoned. When Arn Emmett spied him, he raised a hand, and combat ceased.
"Lord Commander, how may we serve you?"
"With your three best." Emmett grinned.
"Arryn, Emric, Jace."
Horse and Hop-Robin fetched padding for the Lord Commander, along with a ringmail hauberk to go over it, and greaves, gorget, and half-helm. A black shield rimmed with iron for his left arm, a blunted longsword for his right hand. The sword gleamed silvery grey in the dawn light, almost new. One of the last to come from Donald's forge. A pity he didn't live long enough to put an edge on it. The blade was shorter than Longclaw, but made of common steel, which made it heavier. His blows would be a little slower. "It will serve." John turned to face his foes.
"Come!"
"Which one do you want first?" asked Arryn.
"All three of you, at once."
"Three on one?" Jace was incredulous. "That wouldn't be fair."
He was one of Conway's latest bunch, a cobbler's son from Fair Isle. Maybe that explained it.
"True? Come here."
When he did, John's blade slammed him alongside his head, knocking him off his feet. In the blink of an eye, the boy had a boot on his chest and a sword point at his throat. "War is never fair," John told him. "It's two on one now, and you're dead." When he heard gravel crunch, he knew the twins were coming. Those two will make rangers yet. He spun, blocking Aaron's cut with the edge of his shield, and meeting Emric's with his sword.
"Those aren't spears!" he shouted. "Get in close!"
He went to the attack to show them how it was done. Emric first. He slashed at his head and shoulders, right and left and right again. The boy got his shield up and tried a clumsy counter-cut. John slammed his own shield into Emric's and brought him down with a blow to the lower leg, none too soon, because Arryn was on him, with a crunching cut to the back of his thigh which sent him to one knee. "That will leave a bruise." He caught the next cut and his shield, then lurched back to his feet and drove Arryn across the yard. "He's quick," he thought, as the long swords kissed once and twice and thrice. "But he needs to get stronger." When he saw relief in Aaron's eyes, he knew Emric was behind him. He came around and dealt him a cut to the back of the shoulders that sent him crashing into his brother. By that time Jace had found his feet, so John put him down again. "I hate it when dead men get up. You'll feel the same the day you meet a wight." Stepping back, he lowered his sword.
"The big crow can peck the little crows," growled a voice behind him. "But has he belly enough to fight a man?"
Rattleshirt was leaning against the wall. A coarse stubble covered his sunken cheeks, and thin brown hair was blowing across his little yellow eyes. "You'll flatter yourself," John said.
"Aye, but I'll flatten you."
Stannis burned the wrong man.
"No."
The wildling grinned at him through a mouth of brown and broken teeth.
"He burned the man he had to burn, for all the world to see. We all do what we have to do, Snow, even kings."
"Emmett, find some armor for him. I want him in steel, not old bones." Once clad in mail and plate, the Lord of Bones seemed to stand a little straighter. He seemed taller, too, his shoulders thicker and more powerful than John would have thought. "It's the armor, not the man," he told himself. Even Sam could appear almost formidable, clad head to heel in Donald Noy's steel. The wildling waved away the shield Horse offered him. Instead, he asked for a two-handed sword.
"There's a sweet sound," he said, slashing at the air. "Flap closer, Snow, or I mean to make your feathers fly."
John rushed him hard. Rattleshirt took a step backwards and met the charge with a two-handed slash. If John had not interposed his shield, it might have staved his breastplate in and broken half his ribs. The force of the blow staggered him for a moment and sent a solid jolt up his arm. He hits harder than I would have thought. His quickness was another unpleasant surprise. They circled round each other, trading blow for blow. The Lord of Bones gave as good as he was getting. By right, the two-handed greatsword should have been a deal more cumbersome than John's longsword, but the wildling wielded it with blinding speed. Arn Emmett's fledglings cheered their Lord Commander at the start, but the relentless speed of Rattleshirt's attack soon beat them down to silence.
"He cannot keep this up for long," John told himself as he stopped another blow.
The impact made him grunt. Even dulled, the greatsword cracked his pinewood shield and bent the iron rim.
"He will tire soon. He must."
John slashed at the wildling's face, and Rattleshirt pulled back his head. He hacked down at Rattleshirt's calf, only to have him deftly leap the blade. The greatsword crashed down onto John's shoulder, hard enough to ding his pauldron and numb the arm beneath. John backed away. The Lord of Bones came after, chortling. "He has no shield," John reminded himself, "and that monster sword's too cumbersome for parries. I should be landing two blows for every one of his." Somehow he wasn't, though, and the blows he did land were having no effect. The wildling always seemed to be moving away or sliding sideways, so John's longsword glanced off a shoulder or an arm. Before long he found himself giving more ground, trying to avoid the other's crashing cuts and failing half the time. His shield had been reduced to kindling. He shook it off his arm. Sweat was running down his face and stinging his eyes beneath his helm.
"He is too strong and too quick," he realized, "and with that great sword he has weight and reach on me."
It would have been a different fight if John had been armed with Longclaw, but his chance came on Rattleshirt's next backswing. John threw himself forward, bullying into the other man, and they went down together, legs entangled. Steel slammed on steel. Both men lost their swords as they rolled on the hard ground. The wildling drove a knee between John's legs. John lashed out with a mailed fist. Somehow Rattleshirt ended up on top. With John's head in his hands, he smashed it against the ground, then wrenched his visor open.
"If I had me a dagger, you'd be less than I by now,"
he snarled, before Horse and Iron Emmett dragged him off the Lord Commander's chest.
"Let go me, you bloody crows!" he roared.
John struggled to one knee. His head was ringing, and his mouth was full of blood. He spat it out and said, "Well fought."
"You flatter yourself, crow. I never broke a sweat."
"Next time you will," said John. Dolorous Ed helped him to his feet and unbuckled his helm. It had acquired several deep dents that had not been there when he donned it. "Release him." John tossed the helm to Hop Robin, who dropped it. "My lord," said Iron Emmett, "he threatened your life, we all heard. He said that if he had a dagger..." "He does have a dagger. Right there, on his belt." "There is always someone quicker and stronger," Sir Roderick had once told John and Rob. "He's the man you want to face in the yard, before you need to face his like upon a battlefield."
"Lord Snow,"
a soft voice said. He turned to find Clytus standing beneath the broken archway, a parchment in his hand. "From Stannis?" John had been hoping for some word from the king. The Night's Watch took no part in you, and it should not matter to him which king emerged triumphant. Somehow it did. "Is it Deepwood?"
No, my lord."
Clytus thrust the parchment forward. It was tightly rolled and sealed with a button of hard pink wax. "Only the Dreadfort uses pink sealing wax." John ripped off his gauntlet, took the letter, cracked the seal. When he saw the signature, he forgot the battering Rattleshirt had given him. "Ramsay Bolton, Lord of the Hornwood," it read, in a huge spiky hand. The brown ink came away in flakes when John brushed it with his thumb. Beneath Bolton's signature, Lord Dustin, Lady Serwin, and four Risewells had appended their own marks and seals. A cruder hand had drawn the giant of House Umber. "Might we know what it says, my lord?" asked Iron Emmet. John saw no reason not to tell him. "Moat Cailin is taken. The flayed corpses of the Iron Men have been nailed to posts